as a microcosm of Western crisis. It is very much a presentation in development, under development, meaning that I haven't done it that often. I have notes for once to use, and that I hope you will help me develop it. What I'd like to propose that we do is I go through five categories of ways in which I think South Africa reflects in miniature a kind of microcosm of the same problems that exist between the First World and the Third World, the growing crisis in that respect. And I'd like to go through five categories and list several points in each category and ask you, as other ideas or other parallels that you may be aware of that apply to a given category, if you just jot those down and make a note of them, and then at the end we'll have some time in which I'll ask you to share with me, and in that sense to further develop this notion that Southern Africa is really just a microcosm of the situation that we Westerners are in vis-a-vis our relations with the Third World. The first category that I want to talk about are historical parallels. Those of you who take notes have probably been frustrated during my past sessions because of the difficulty in making notes on the way I presented. You'll be pleased this morning because this is a very logical, straightforward thing. You know, it's got A, B, C, so forth and so on. 6 points under historical parallels that I want to make. And I'll try and go through them real quickly so that we have a little more time for discussion at the end. The first is date of settlement. Whites began settling in Southern Africa in 1652. It was earlier in the same century that they began settling here in North America. In other words, there was this going out from Europe of a very similar type white population with very similar worldviews, both to Southern Africa and also to North America at about the same time. Secondly, both groups impinged on an indigenous population. In both situations, they came into a territory where there was an indigenous population living. And they really had to take control of that land. And I believe that's not just a fact in our historical past. It's something that works on our consciousness today. We all know it. We all know that we stole this land from the Indians. And regardless of how we feel about that, I think it does influence our deep within our psyche, our own sense of belonging here. Thirdly, that the work ethic in both Southern Africa and also North America was used as a rationale for the land grab. In both places, you read the history books and it's virtually the same, the excuses that were made for why it was okay to take the land away from the indigenous peoples. In both situations, we said, these people are lazy, they're not working the land, God created the land that it should be used, it should be tilled, and cultivated and brought to bear fruit. That's the intention of God's creation. And because the indigenous peoples aren't using it in this way, it's not only okay, but it's actually our manifest destiny that we should take control of the land and teach them how to use it, and by setting a different example ourselves. Fourthly, in both Southern Africa and also North America, it was military technology that really provided the key to a white success at being able to encroach themselves onto this territory which was occupied by other people. In both cases, I think the key factor allowing whites to get away with taking the land and living out their rationales for why it was good for them to take the land. In both cases, it was military technology, superior weapons of war, which allowed us to get away with our ideas. Fifthly, white expansion in these territories was really the product of a government incompetence to prevent it. In both cases, there was a government that said, we will try and restrict our population to a given area, and said to the indigenous peoples, this area is yours, and we will keep the whites here, and you can have this territory. And in both cases, the government was incompetent, or at least unwilling, to prevent that that spread. There were laws in southern Africa restricting the white population to the Cape region, and the African chiefdoms that were located to the north of the Cape had been given assurances that whites would be kept inside of the Cape. But due to the politics of the white government in South Africa and the hostility that grew between the whites in the urban area of Cape Town and the rural whites in the countryside, the rural whites at one point just decided to leave the Cape, and they went north on their own. I read in the last year, I finally read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, is that the one? Yeah. Which has such an extensive chronicling of promises made to a Native American population about how we would respect the integrity of certain territorial integrities of theirs. And then the excuse that, well, they couldn't, when various mineral deposits were found on Indian territories, the government really was unable to prevent miners from coming in, or unwilling, either unwilling or unable. I think you could argue which it was. And sixthly, in both cases, it was really the spread of a Puritan people. There's been a good book written by De Klerk, published by Penguin, called The Puritans in Africa, on the Afrikaner people in southern Africa. And there's one whole section in that book which parallels the Puritanism that came and settled in New England with the Puritanism that went and settled in southern Africa. And there are very strong parallels between this worldview that here were a group of people who were fleeing political and social chaos in Europe and had come now to a virgin land where they would be called to bring into being the kingdom of God. And that notion of our destiny to bring to being the kingdom of God here on earth in a concrete political and social and economic fashion has been an important symbol in the history of the American people. It's still at work, I believe, in the kinds of rationales exhibited in Washington for what we need to do to bring freedom to various parts of the world. And that same, I believe that that's a function of the same type of rationale that works in the minds of the Afrikaners who say that God sent them to Africa to spread Western Christian civilization among an uncivilized and backward people, and that, this is part of a kind of Puritan ethic which is at work both in North America and also on the part of whites in Southern Africa today. So those are a few historical parallels. I hope others have come to your mind, and you just make a note of those and share them with me when we a little bit later on. But an example that there are some strong historic parallels between the development of North American society and white dominance in Southern Africa. A second category that I want to talk about is economic systems. And the first point I would make under the category of economic systems is the fact that we both here in North America and also in Southern Africa have an economic system which exhibits a great deal of interdependence between the need for natural resources and a more industrialized sector of our economy. There's an interplay here between the industrialized sector of our economy and the need for natural resources. The industrialized sector doesn't work without access to natural resources. And this interplay or interdependence between these two factors is crucial to our economic system and, I believe, becomes an important part of how we face the future. It was interesting, maybe I mentioned earlier this week that when James Watt came into his current role in Washington, one of the first things he did was draw up a list of vitally strategic natural resources, a list of minerals that he considered the U.S. to be vitally dependent upon, that were vital to our national interest, our national security. It's interesting that that list reads almost verbatim like a list of major South African exports. I don't think, just a statement of his interest in Southern Africa, but a statement of the degree to which we are, our whole economy is crucially dependent on access to mineral resources in that part of the world. And thus we fear, for very basic, self-interested economic reasons, a change of leadership in Southern Africa, which might threaten our status quo access to those mineral resources. The threat goes up that the Soviets are going to come in and that they're going to deny us access to those resources, and that therefore we would be kind of in a stranglehold by the Soviets. I don't buy that at all, because that would destroy the economy of Southern Africa. And there's no way the people there are going to cut us off in a kind of suicide of their own, just out of some ideological hatred for us. First of all, they don't have an ideological hatred for us. And secondly, it is in their interest to do business with us by selling us their natural resources. What probably would be the case is that those mineral resources would cost us more money. Either the price that we pay for them would go up, or that the percentage of profit which we make off of our corporations that mine them would go down. So certain parts of the private sector in the U.S. would be likely to make less profit, or in other cases we might actually have to pay more for our access to those mineral resources. But I don't believe that we would lose access to them. And that factor is present in the minds of the South African government too. The South African economy knows that that its industrialized sector needs access to certain mineral resources. South Africa is particularly self-sufficient so far as that goes, much more so than our own society. They are really self-sufficient in every respect except oil. That's the one crucial economic natural resource which the South Africans need. They were getting about 90% of their oil from the Shah of Iran, and one of the first things that the revolutionary government in Iran did was announce that they would no longer honor the contracts for oil supply to South Africa that the Shah had engaged in. So today the South Africans have to buy their oil on the international spot market, which is much more expensive. They are hard at work with the aid of American technology to overcome that dependence on imported oil by way of developing the most sophisticated oil from coal technology in the world. South Africans have vast deposits of coal in South Africa, and they are in the process of setting up the most sophisticated extraction of oil from coal plants in the world, really, with the aid of the Fluor Corporation from Southern California. And as soon as that project comes full cycle, it'll take a few more years for it to happen, then there's really no natural resource that the South Africans will be critically dependent on us, or on the outside world for. They will still want our technology, our computers, and that sort of thing. But their industrialized economy can run in an unparalleled self-sufficient fashion. And in that sense, maybe they're a little bit different from us, who are more dependent on importation. So interdependence of natural resources and the industrialized sector is the first point I want to make about economic system. Second point is that both systems, it seems to me, and I mentioned this earlier in the week, have a base which is too broad for democratic practice. In both Southern Africa and the United States, there is this strong notion that we have democratic societies. I mean, it might sound ridiculous to us that the South Africans think of themselves as a democracy, but they do. White South Africans believe at almost an unquestionable level of assumption that, of course, they have a Western-style democracy, just as we believe it. But in both cases, both our own society and their society, we have economies which are much broader than our democratic base. There's no question in my own mind that the U.S. economy is critically dependent on cheap labor in Central America. or, you know, in many different parts of the world. Our economy is critically dependent on cheap labor and the access to natural resources, et cetera, et cetera. And we have been unable to extend democracy as broadly as we have extended our economic tentacles. In fact, there are quite a few people who argue pretty strongly that it's not, you know, I suppose some people in Washington would just say, well, that's not really our fault. We do business with the people in El Salvador, but what kind of political system they have is really their own business. Well, maybe they wouldn't say that about El Salvador, but they certainly would about most of the other countries in South America. And yet, historically, there's a strong case can be made that where democracy has begun to take root in a broader fashion, such as in Chile, then the private sector and even the governing sector of our own society step in and return those societies to a military dictatorship or to or set up some kind of a military civilian junta or whatever. In any event, we have an economic system which is much broader than, which is too broad to support a democratic base. Yet we maintain a self-image of ourselves as democratic. And that's just a myth, I think. Thirdly, we both have economies which thrive. Some people would even go further and say which economies which are dependent upon a supply of cheap labor. And in both cases, the economic system is one which profits, which is really at its best when it is ensured access to vast supplies of cheap labor. Yeah, John.
I'm assuming that you're talking mostly about our multinational corporations. Or are you talking about cheap labor here in the U.S.? Because it seems to me that part of the problem that many U.S. companies are having in dealing with Japanese and other competition is that the labor costs in this country tend to be higher.
That's right, and I think
that influences the multinationals to export their operations so that they can get the cheap labor.
Which, as I see it, is a proof that our economic system is viable only when it is ensured access to cheap labor. And it's not just a multinational phenomenon, though. I think it's also a factor which is understood very well by our government, and which shows up in such things as our immigration policies. You know, the whole current Reagan administration's revision of policies towards Mexicans who come into the United States to work is very closely tuned to the needs of our economy. And so I would say that, and in Southern Africa, of course, the setup of the Bantustans are designed to ensure that, you know, the South Africans say that they set up these homelands, these Bantustans, which are going to be independent black states, but really which are territories that have no economic base other than exported labor. So they're creating so-called independent states whose only economy is based on migrant labor. And when you have a state like that that has no economic basis other than exporting its labor, it becomes a kind of insurance for the industrialized sector in the so-called white areas of South Africa that they can depend on having this access to cheap labor.
And in other words, our Bantustans are outside of
our Bantustans are found in Central America.
Yeah.
And the only thing about the South and elsewhere, Southeast Asia and many other parts of the world. And the only, and just as black workers can't make a living in their Bantustans, and so they have to come into white South Africa to work, likewise, people on our borders have to come into the United States. Or I've seen some amazing statistics recently about, particularly in the Caribbean region, And the percentage of people from Puerto Rico, for example, who at some point or another in their lifetime work in the United States. Dan, you want to?
Well, the other part of that is our building factories and assembly plants in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
60 Minutes recently had on General Electric moving their iron assembly plant from Idaho to Mexico. How it hurt the economy of this town at this time.
Mm-hmm. And it seems, I mean, I don't think that we can, I think we ought to discipline ourselves to accept that economics and politics go hand in hand, and that it's a myth to say we have a political system which has boundaries in the form of the United States of America and an economic system which is broad. They both go hand in hand. And if our economic system is dependent on an undemocratic way, then it's we're kidding ourselves to think that we live in a democratic system. We live in a system which extends democratic rights to a certain elite, but which depends on a broader base of people who do not get democratic rights. Third category I want to talk about is underclass expectations. It seems to me that both in Southern Africa and also in the Third World generally, there are a growing set of expectations on the part of the underclass, which bear a lot of parallels with each other. These rising expectations in the first place are related to, I believe, Western education. It is the export of a Western educational system which is directly responsible for raising the expectations of people beyond our borders. It's kind of ironic that we've always felt that the problems of the world could be solved by giving them more education, and we've been eager to export our educational system and structure method. And it is that system which is now producing on the part of leaders in the Third World or in South Africa I guess in the last 20 or 30 minutes I've been really focusing on North America, and I'm kind of assuming that you see the parallel in South Africa. Maybe I should switch and assume that you know the parallel in North America and rather point out how this is true in Southern Africa. Whites in South Africa have long said to the black people, we want to develop you up to our level. And the best way for you to get developed up to our level is to get education. And so the ethic has long been in South Africa that a black person who wants to get ahead should get Western education. Now, it's kind of ironic that the blacks in South Africa today who are most militant about the need for change are those who have the most education, Western-type education. You've got three groups of black people. I've got a tape back there on history and people of South Africa where I talk about the different types of black people, a third of them being farm laborers, a third of them living in the black reservations, and a third of them in the urban areas. That urban area group are the ones who have the most exposure to Western education and are the most civilized. The people listening to the tape can't see my quotation marks with my fingers here, but they're, by civilized, I'm quoting the white concept. I don't really think that blacks are uncivilized. Yet it is those well-educated blacks in the urban areas who are the most militant today in their demands vis-a-vis the South African government. A second way in which the expectations of an underclass have been raised are, I think, modern communication and transportation. When people start traveling around or communicating via the mass media, then they inevitably, their expectations rise. If you live in a remote part of South Africa and you now get exposed to television, or via television, you get exposed to how other people live, it's only natural that that should influence the rising of your expectations for what you want in life. And so I think these inevitable dimensions of growing methods of communication and transportation, ought to let us know that we're headed in a direction from which we cannot turn, and we cannot hide. Thirdly, geopolitical developments are influencing rising expectations. By this, I mean, you remember on Wednesday night, I talked about the geopolitical situation in southern Africa, how there was the, South Africa at the southern tip, blacks in South Africa have been influenced by the fact that the buffer zone separating white-dominated South Africa from black Africa, that buffer zone has been crumbling. And as it does so, blacks in South Africa see the day coming, see history on their side. They, especially urban and well-educated blacks in South Africa, know that it's only a matter of time, that as they read the history books, time after time, there have been white-dominated colonies to the north in Africa where whites have claimed that they would be in charge for centuries to come, just as they claim that in South Africa today, and yet blacks come to power at some point. And as those, as blacks gain power closer and closer to the borders of South Africa, that has a tremendous impact on the people of, on black expectations in South Africa, just as I believe certain changes in Nicaragua have had a tremendous impact on the faith and hope of people elsewhere in Central America, that changes are possible and can come. Or Iran, I think, has been a big lesson to people in the third world, that a well-armed state with tremendous and extensive military assistance from the United States can still be overthrown by a popular revolution. That lesson, I think, was directly responsible to a certain extent for what happened in Nicaragua not too long afterwards. Fourthly, a justice-oriented theology is making a big impact, both in on the part of blacks in southern Africa and also on the part of people elsewhere in the third world. You all, I'm sure, are very familiar with the role that Vatican II and the Catholic Church have played in rising expectations in Central America. Likewise, it is a justice-oriented theology, a reading of the Bible and its concern for justice on the part of black Lutherans in Namibia, which have convinced them and have given them the kind of a deep, unshakable faith that their cause is right and is just, and that they can expect to have a better day, to have a better day in the future. And that solid, deep faith, I think, is ultimately more powerful than guns. And so where people have that faith and are faced on the other side with guns, it's, I think, safe to assume they will overcome. Political ideology, I want to divide this category into two sections. One is the political ideology held by whites, and the other is political ideology held by blacks. Take the blacks first. Biko says that in South Africa, 15 or 20 years ago, the white government could have proposed reforms by way of giving blacks a larger slice of the pie, and that would have probably pacified the blacks, that it would have won the whites a lot of time in terms of their the growing pressures for them to make changes, that had whites given blacks a bigger slice of the pie a little earlier on, that would have worked. However, as a result of one of the real focuses of the black consciousness, of his black consciousness movement, was to convince blacks not to be satisfied with a larger slice of the pie. He says that what blacks are looking for in South Africa today is the opportunity, as the majority population, to bake a pie according to their own recipe. They don't want a larger slice of a white baked pie. They want to bake a black recipe. And it seems to me that that is a factor. It certainly is a factor in the political ideology of black South Africans, and also, I believe, in the ideology of people elsewhere in the third world, that they don't want a better deal from us. They want the right to set up their own system in a cooperative fashion with ours. I don't think that, as we fear, they are out to do our system in, unless our system is dependent on their exploitation of them, which it may be. But I don't believe that that's the only way our system can function. I believe that's the way it is functioning right now, and that our traditional notion of the health of our system is dependent on that type of exploitation. But I think that the development of some alternative recipes around the world in the form of economic pies will force us to cooperate in a fashion that modifies our system and maintains some of our strengths. You find in an effort to create a more socialist-oriented economy in a place like Zimbabwe, or Cuba for that matter, a strong respect for the profit motive. I was surprised to hear, in talking to some friends who visited Cuba recently, that the Cuban government does not deny the importance of the profit motive. It says to its people that they are free to set up, in addition to their main job, if they want to set up a little business as a little shoe repair business on the side, they are entirely free to do that, recognizing that this opportunity to make a little income on the side through one's own initiative, that promise of profit, is a powerful motivator to an economy. What the Cuban government says is that if you want to set up a shoemaking shop on the side, you must, that all of the people, that you cannot hire somebody to work for you, that all the people running that shoe repair business have to do so in a kind of a collective fashion. They have to have an equal slice of the profits, so that kind of prevents a situation in which you have at the top of a business somebody who's kind of the executive director and takes a bigger share of the profit than the people underneath.
I was wondering whether there was any, is there a requirement in Cuba that people who want to, say, set up their own business, that it always has to be on the side in addition to a full-time job, or can they just do that and have that be their full-time job?
Does anybody know? Yeah, I don't.
Because if they can't, that really puts a very strong crimp on that, because very few people are going to have the energy to be able to put a lot of time into such a side business if they have to work a full-time job elsewhere.
Yeah, I don't know. I cite it as an example that the socialist economies, which we often hear badmouthed because they refuse to recognize the reality that the profit motive is a motivator. I mean, that's, you know, what's so big in our system. We say that we've discovered a profound truth, that profit motivates initiative. And I'm citing this one example, and I'm no expert on Cuba. I know very little about Cuba. That there is plenty of evidence that in third world socialist economies, there is a recognition that the profit motive does create initiative, inspire initiative, and that what they seek to do is bring some of that in a kind of controlled fashion into their own economies, and then it becomes a mixed economy.
Yeah. I think actually that the same thing works in this country. You can put in a 40-hour week, but you're not going to get very far in the U.S. debate doing just that. If you're an executive, you're putting in, you know, if you're really hustling and ambitious, you're putting in a lot more in 40 hours. And if you're a working man, you're taking on an extra job, so that even in this country, you know, if you have a profit motive, if you want to get ahead or whatever, you put in more than 40 hours a week, and if you just want to serve time, you know, put in your 40.
A second factor in the political ideology of blacks in South Africa is a long-standing and very proud tradition among the black people of nonviolent resistance. This is a factor almost completely unknown on the part of white South Africans as it is in our own society. Yet I can tell you from personal experience that it is deeply embarrassing and humiliating to go to a black South African who advocates the use of violence in their situation and tell them that they are wrong, because what they will answer to you is, do you know our history of using nonviolence? And there is a very long and proud history of attempting to use nonviolence, to the point where some observers who have studied that history say that the basic problem of the African people is that they have been too tolerant and too patient. They have certainly have been far more willing to use nonviolent methods than most Western cultures in the gaining of their political rights. In South Africa, there is I have a tape on black resistance in South Africa, which explores some of that history which needs to be explored. It is not an excuse for the coverage of that history, but it is a pointing to some of the dimensions of that long history. In 1912, the African National Congress, which is the primary guerrilla group operating in South Africa today. In 1912, the African National Congress was born. And a basic plank of its platform was nonviolent legal resistance. In 1949, they dropped their commitment to legal activity but kept their commitment to nonviolence. And it behooves us, I believe, before we presume to judge the appropriateness of their tactics, to at least familiarize ourselves with their tradition of nonviolent resistance. Anyway, I'm getting more into white ideology. I need to stick to the black ideology. This factor of a longstanding tradition of nonviolent resistance is very important to the political ideology that blacks have today. They know that they have that history, and that's an important part of how they formulate their ideology and their tactics today. Thirdly, and I've alluded to this already a little bit, there is the quest for creative experimentation. In the West, we have the tendency to see ourselves as kind of at the end of a history of experimentation where various systems have been tried out and various methods have been experimented with, and we feel we've come up with the only alternatives that exist: free enterprise or communism. And we tend to see the whole world as really having to choose between one system or the other. And there is in the ideology of blacks in South Africa, and I believe people in the third world generally, this quest to want to be creative, to say, well, you know, you people have, you whites in the West have done some experimentation and they've made some insights and made some mistakes. Now we want a chance to experiment ourselves. We think that from our different cultural backgrounds, we might come up with some new ideas of our own. And we want the right not to be forced into one camp or the other in a kind of superpower dichotomy, but to create a third system, which is much more creative and experimental. As far as white political ideology is concerned, one factor I've already mentioned is the ignorance of blacks' nonviolent tradition. In South Africa, in one of the films I distribute is a history of black nationalism in South Africa called Generations of Resistance, which will be getting a lot of television exposure later this year. And at one point, a guy who served time on Robben Island, which is where political prisoners are assigned in South Africa, talks about one incident in 10 years or so ago when Jimmy Kruger, the Minister of Justice in South Africa, our equivalent would be the Attorney General, visited Robben Island. And black people pointed out to him, he came onto Robben Island and he started preaching to the blacks and he said, you know, you guys are just seeking to overthrow the state through violence. You're not reasonable at all. You know, we have no choice but to incarcerate you like this. And Nelson Mandela, the leader of the most widely acknowledged leader of blacks in South Africa, who has been in prison for 20 years now and is serving a life sentence, and if the white South Africans have their way, will never be released. Mandela began pointing out to Jimmy Kruger the long history that black South Africans had of trying to work nonviolently and some of the experiences that they had. And this guy talking in the film says that Kruger responded that he was unaware of that history. And that's true. White South Africans, just as Westerners in this country, are totally unaware of the history of nonviolent resistance that Third World and black peoples in South Africa have. And it seems to me that that's a kind of isolation which is a critical part of our overall ideology and enables us to very self-righteously condemn the use of force. I don't say that that's the only condemnation of the use of force which gets aired, but it is crucial to the way in which we condemn the use of force, or a lot of us do anyway, I think. A second factor in white ideology is racism. More and more, the more I think about this, and I guess with every passing year, I get more and more convinced that racism is a deep part of our ideology, and that we are left bankrupt from that. A second and related factor, this would be the third point under white political ideology, is a chauvinism, a kind of belief, a chauvinistic belief that at a deep level of almost unquestioned assumptions, that our way is best. And we may not believe, as the missionaries did, that German should be taught before people are given instruction in baptism. You know, it may not be that blatant. Did I talk about this earlier in the week, how German Missouri Synod Lutheran missionaries, which is my background, in Michigan among Native Americans or in Africa among blacks, there was a time in our mission history when we refused to offer people instruction in baptism. We refused to offer the natives instruction leading to baptism until they first learned to speak the only language that God understands. All good German Lutherans know that the only language God understands is German. People better speak German before they can begin to get into this relationship with God. And that's the kind of cultural chauvinism which is still deep. You know, we refer to uneducated blacks in South Africa, by which we mean they have not had access to Western-type educational institutions. And we tend to assume that because they haven't been in Western-type schools, they have no education. Ignoring the fact that there are very sophisticated educational structures and methods in Africa long before whites ever arrived, and that maybe they used some more profound and some more educationally valuable techniques, such as the telling of proverbs, which increasingly today we recognize as a good educational method. Ignorance of the nonviolent tradition, racism, chauvinism, a fourth A factor in the white political ideology would be what I call surrogate transfer. The idea that we should transfer our direct control to a surrogate body of people. In South Africa, this takes the form of setting up reservations or Bantustans where the whites cultivate a black elite who think and act the way they do and are given privileges because they are willing to do so. In Namibia, the government ministers, apartheid has ended in Namibia today for those government ministers who cooperate in the South African system, because they are paid salaries by virtue of their positions in the government, which enable them to buy homes in the white areas. A few years ago, there was a lot of noise about how Namibia was ending apartheid. Blacks were going to be free to buy land in white areas now if they wanted to. Of course, you had to be able to afford to do so, and no blacks in the country can do that except those who are willing to sit in the government and approve these policies for which they are paid sums that enable them to move into the white neighborhood. So you extend privileges to a surrogate black elite who are willing to work with you, and in that way it appear to transfer leadership. I think the same thing is true in Central America, you know, where we put into power a junta in El Salvador, which then carries out our policies for us. Fifthly, what I call the self-fulfilling prophecies of doom. In Southern Africa, whites will tell you that they believe unquestionably that if blacks were to come to power, the whole system is going to fail, and the economy is going to fall into ruins, etc., etc., etc. in Mozambique, which I talked to the other night about how that was a Portuguese colony until 1975. The whites were under white minority rule. When black freedom fighters came to power in Mozambique in 1975, there was a mass exodus of whites, which left the economy crippled. Because hitherto you had an economy which was in which all the skilled labor and all of the managerial class were whites. Now suddenly a high percentage of the white population exits the country, the economy falls into ruin, and that's lifted up as an example of how a Marxist state can never, you know, can't succeed. Or another aspect of the self-fulfilling prophecy of doom that whites in South Africa are deathly afraid today of this, of any success that the new black government in Zimbabwe might have, because the ties between whites in Zimbabwe and whites in South Africa are profound, and there's a fear that if whites in Zimbabwe are converted, there's not been the mass exodus from Zimbabwe that there was from Mozambique, partly because of efforts on the part of the blacks who came to power to say to the whites, we need you and we want to work with you, and to be very cautious about keeping those white people in the country as they begin to train blacks for those positions. And so the government fears that whites might be converted in Zimbabwe to a belief that, well, maybe the takeover of blacks wasn't so bad. It at least ended the war, and, you know, we live in much better harmony today, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a very sophisticated and active campaign to economically and violently, I might add, sabotage certain institutions in Zimbabwe. For example, the Zimbabwe at the moment has been dependent on all of its oil from South Africa. The importation of oil into Zimbabwe comes via South Africa. Now, there was a pipeline from Mozambique over to Zimbabwe. Here's Mozambique, South Africa, there's Zimbabwe. There is a pipeline from Maputo, which is a major point, into Zimbabwe. Now, that pipeline was not used during the war because Mozambique was engaged in economic sanctions against Zimbabwe. As soon as the war was over, plans were made to complete that pipeline so that Zimbabwe could import its oil from through Mozambique instead of having to be dependent on South Africa, because South Africa was engaged in all kinds of an extensive program of sabotaging the Zimbabwean economy by not... See, the rail traffic goes through here, and South trains would come into South Africa, and South Africa would not let them return to Zimbabwe. And all kinds of things. Africa News has done some good stories chronicling that sabotage. Last December, just a few months ago, about a month before that pipeline was due to open, it was blown up. And there have been some subsequent discoveries of, how to prove to you that the South Africans did it, in 30 seconds or less. Read African News. That'd be the best way to find out. There's a resistance movement of white Mozambicans who have never accepted the takeover by blacks and who have been carrying out a guerrilla sabotage against Mozambique ever since 1975. When there was a white minority government in Zimbabwe, that resistance movement was given a lot of support and refuge here in Zimbabwe. Now that there's a black government in Zimbabwe, that movement has had to move to South Africa for its support. Recently, the Mozambicans captured a major guerrilla hideout and headquarters for this white Mozambican resistance movement in Mozambique. And what they found were all kinds of documentation, much of it written in Afrikaans, from some South African military leaders, indicating extensive cooperation between white South African military personnel and these sabotage campaigns. Also, there's been people who have inspected the blowing up of that pipeline have indicated that that while the white Mozambican resistance group, which claimed credit for blowing up that line, is a very sophisticated group, they say that the nature of the explosives used and the degree of technical expertise present are indicated by how those explosives were placed on that bridge in order to cause maximum damage. It goes far beyond the sophistication of that white Mozambican resistance movement, and then it would have required some much higher level of sophistication. And the only people in that part of the world that would have it would be the South Africans. so. But, I mean, that's not really a proof that the South Africans did it. But there's no question in my own mind that they are responsible for this kind of economic sabotage of black systems. And that's an example of how a part of the white political ideology which prophesies doom if blacks take over is self-fulfilling.
A very similar happened in Chile too, a small happened in Nicaragua.
No.
Economic system.
That's right. To prove that these systems can't work. Yeah. And finally, the monolithic. You know the term monolithic? The idea of monolithic means that it's all one. It's has some kind of an organic whole. The monolithic view of Marxism and communism, I think, is basic to white political ideology. Our failure to distinguish between the varieties of Marxist beliefs or the varieties of communist system, you know, our failure to recognize that maybe the type of Marxism carried out or practiced in a state like Nicaragua, where the church is so strong, might differ from the type of Marxism practiced in Cuba, where the church is not as active in the social and political structures of the state, or in the Soviet Union, you know, whatever. We have this notion, and it comes through consistently in the way the word Marxist is used, the label, and the way it's applied to people. It is always presumed by whites as a part of their political ideology that Marxism and communism is all some one organic whole. It all means the same thing. The final category that I want to focus on is moral faith. Just 3 points here. One factor present in the moral faith of white South Africans, and also I believe of whites in the, well, people in the First World, is a kind of a contradiction present in our sense of morality or our moral faith. Contradiction between the claim that we are a peaceful people, a people of peace, and our practice of militarism. Now, we all know plenty of good examples of how that's true for the Alexander Haigs and the Ronald Reagans and the And I can tell you it's also true of white Afrikaners, this belief that we are a peace-loving people. You know, I used to burn up inside listening to Nixon's speeches in the late 60s and early 70s about, you know, our quest for peace as we send bombers out. You know, the belief that we're a peaceful people, but our reliance upon militaristic practice. We all know other whites who engage in that kind of dichotomy. The tougher thing for us to swallow is the fact that people like Biko say that this is true not only of conservative whites in South Africa and North America, but that it tends to be a factor present on the part of all people. And there's a sense in which the way of life that you and I know and enjoy and experience is reliant upon a very militaristic system, yet we maintain a belief that we are a people of peace. And that there is a contradiction in our moral faith, I think, which extends for all of us, and which we live between the belief that we are a peaceful people and the more objective analysis, the analysis that comes from outside of us, which it says that our way of life is reliant upon militarism. So that's one factor on the part of whites in Southern Africa, which I think is paralleled in the First World as well. A second aspect of our moral faith is the relationship between our concept of mission and development. Mission and development. By development, I refer to that whole school of thought or notion of how does one best develop a third world people. In South Africa, whites are always talking about developing blacks. and helping them come up to our way of life, our standard of living, so forth and so on. And I think that crucial to our philosophy of developing other people, of sharing our gifts with other people, is our concept of Christian mission. I've got a tape on, I think it's called Who Are the Christians of Southern Africa? Or it's the tape on the independent churches, in which I try and describe the difference between the type of mission that we've been carrying out, a mission which says we have it, the gospel, and we're called to duplicate our understanding of the gospel among other people. You know, we have the best way of life available, and our responsibility is to share that way of life with other people. I think that, that notion of development and that concept of mission go hand in hand. And it stands apart, I believe, from the kind of mission to which we are called, which I believe God created a diverse order of creation, not for one segment of that creation to conquer all the rest, but so that every segment of creation would gain through an encounter with each other. And so I believe that the kind of mission to which we're called by God is a mission of encountering people in a productive fashion, where both we and them are mutually changed. And I think there's a link between our concept of mission and our concept of development, and that before we presume to change our political and social ways of relating to the rest of the world, we better work on our theological concept of mission. Thirdly, finally, and this is probably the single most important point that I want to make this morning, I believe that there is a counter-relevancy. I don't say a non-relevancy, but actually it's more negative than that. It's not a neutral factor, it's a negative factor. There is a counter-relevancy of a kind of Christian moralism. By Christian moralism, I mean this idea that our living, it seeks to do good for others. That the most, you know, that basic to our value system is the idea that we should live not to gratify ourselves, but that we should do good for others. I'm saying that it is counter-relevant, that this idea, this Christian moralism, otherness focused, is counter-relevant. It's negative, not just irrelevant, it's counter-relevant in the context of isolation from the people that we seek to help. We would better not even claim to be trying to help people if we're not going to be better informed about them. And I can think of, white South Africans believe, Afrikaners particularly, more so than the English-speaking white South Africans, Afrikaners believe deeply that their system is good for other people. And they believe at the deepest level of their souls that blacks are better off in South Africa than they are anywhere else in Africa. Just as we Americans believe that people in Central America are better off cooperating with us than with the Soviet Union. We think those are the only two options. I'm saying that this sense of moral faith, this idea to this kind of Christian moralism to help other people, in the context of isolation from those peoples, is very dangerous. It's counter-relevant, because one tends to believe, and Kaunda speaks to this very strongly, one tends to believe that in the course of sending bombers into Vietnam and Cambodia, that one is helping those people, and that's worse than to at least admit that we're doing it out of self-interest. Now I hope, I think I mentioned earlier in the week the little clipping that hangs on my bulletin, our bulletin board at home about college students flunk, headlines and college students flunk test on world affairs. The scandal that recently swept briefly through our media about an effort to examine the degree of international interest on the part of Americans. We are a nation of incredible power and influence in the world, but we are also a nation which, even in among other whites in Western Europe, has a reputation of being among the most poorly informed about the world. You read our newspapers, almost nothing in the way of international news. Look at the Seattle Times, you know, one page with a couple of tiny articles on international news. All the rest of it is national news. Yet, we have so much power. And I'm saying that this belief that we do good for others, when coupled with an isolation from the others whom we seek to do good for, is counter-relevant. I didn't leave you much time for a discussion. I did this once before, about a month ago, when I was told, limit yourself to 30 minutes and then we're going to have a discussion. And I took 35, so I thought it would only be 35 this morning, but nobody pressured me. So, but I would like to take 5 or 10 minutes to see if any of you can add to any of the ways in which I've tried to describe Southern Africa as a microcosm.
This isn't a challenge at all to what you said. It's a footnote, and that is, there's been something of a black-white contrast in this, thoroughly true, but you know, where all the black is virtuous and the white is negative, you know, innocent, victim, guilty, oppressor, and us against them. And whereas that is true, there are other truths that don't cancel out what you said. For example, in Southeast Asia, there was this fear, domino theory, monolithic Marxism, we've got to stop it one place because it will sweep all over the place. And that could only be believed in a complete ignorance of the history of the area, where there is ancient antipathy between Vietnam and China, Vietnam and Cambodia, Cambodia and Thailand, Vietnam and Thailand, all those areas. As soon as we pulled out, that antipathy blossomed. Without us as an enemy, they became enemies to each other. And there has been unspeakable genocide in Cambodia, by Cambodians, revolutionary Cambodians. And Vietnam used that as an occasion to move in for a kind of power grab, which is only to say that the propensities you've been talking about have flourished in the West, but they're potentially everywhere. And sin is alive and flourishing and well in Europe and America, but that's not its exclusive home. And I don't mean this to be a challenge to what you've said, but just to,
well, I think
or a solving of our conscience, but to an indication that the people are people, you know, everywhere. And it may, even if we did pull out of the third world as we ought, or, you know, work in a more cooperative way, that still wouldn't necessarily bring the kingdom of God. And there is a capacity for aggression or power moves or whatever everywhere in the world.
I think it supports what I've said along the lines that of the self-fulfilling prophecy of doom and the surrogate transfer of power. I think that the scale of genocide that goes on in a place like Uganda is not strictly the product of African sin. No question that sin exists everywhere on the part of people everywhere. But that Westerners should arm, you know, that the CIA should arm a faction in Angola with the type of weapons that make mass genocide now much, much easier, is a factor for which we do bear direct responsibility. You know, I'm not saying that all would be rosy if it wasn't for our influence, but I don't think that the scale of chaos that reigns in some of the African colonies today would have been the natural product of sin on the part of Africans had they been had they somehow continued to exist apart from our influence. So I think that what you point to is an example that sometimes we can pull out and leave a legacy behind. Let me give you an example of what I mean here. In the Bantustans of South Africa, the homelands, I lived in Transkei, which was the model Bantustan in South Africa, during the year of its so-called transition to South African rule territory right down there. And about a month before this independence was supposed to take place, the government of Transkei, the now black government of Transkei, which was coming into being, said, we're going to hold elections right before independence, just to settle once and for all, to let the people make clear their feelings, whether they want this independence policy or not. And there was a party in the parliament, the majority party. Well, first of all, the parliament of these Bantustans tends to be half chiefs who are appointed by the government and on the government payroll, and then half elected officials. So that a given elected official, you only need to elect one elected official who makes a truce with the chief. The chiefs always tend to reflect the government point of view. So if the chiefs can get one elected official on their side, they have a majority and they control the parliament. The majority party in the Transkei parliament said, we're going to hold these elections. The day before, people began filing petitions to run in these elections, either in favor of independence or opposed to independence. The opposition party, which was opposed to independence, was rounded up and held in detention without charge by the police so that they couldn't participate in the elections. Now, a friend of mine, a journalist, in the Transkei, went along to the Attorney General, the Minister of Justice in the Transkei, who's the brother of the Prime Minister, and said to him, you know, what a blatant miscarriage of justice. How can you claim this is democratic? You know, how can you go about such an obvious manipulation of the democratic process? And his answer reveals, I think, the example I want to cite here. This guy said, well, look, Pretoria, capital of South Africa. Pretoria has long had the right to detain anybody it wants to, anytime it wants to. Now we're getting our independence and we can do the same thing. And there's a sense in which the people who come to power when we finally begrudgingly give up some power tend to reflect our own legacy. Those leaders who come to power in the Bantustans of South Africa today are the progeny of a white totalitarian system. Now, I agree that this presentation has tended to focus on a criticism of the whites and a promise of the black. And that's largely related to the title of the presentation, which is Southern Africa as a Microcosm of Western Crisis. Not an evaluation of Western influence. An evaluation would, by its nature, have to account for both positive aspects and negative aspects. And there's a great deal about the spread of Western influence for which I think blacks are grateful. And I have, there's no question in my mind that when they have the opportunity to run their own systems, that they will thank us and affirm us for a lot about us. But in understanding our crisis, I believe we must look at our limitations. And so that's why I focused in the way that I did. But I'm glad that you reminded me that I didn't. I don't know if you meant to remind me.
No,
but
no,
I guess you didn't. I thought of it as you spoke, and I was glad to be so reminded.
I guess you're talking about this stuff and putting down, talking about the moral thing and the contradiction of the paradox there. And even though I've been here for a while, trying to sort out the stuff, it still seems to me that chauvinism is inherent in our Christianity. You know, I have a really hard time saying, well, I just, for this place, we're theological, blah, 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 but it seems like it's inherent. The chauvinism and all these paradoxes are still inherent in what we're talking about.
Well, I think it is a integral part of the way we have tended to practice Christianity. I don't think it's part of the faith to which we're called by Christ, nor do I think it is such an integral part of the faith of the majority of the way most Christians practice Christianity. Increasingly, most Christians are not white Westerners anymore. And one of the reasons, I mean, one of the great gifts that we have to gain from an African practice of Christianity, I think, is to remind us that this chauvinism, which is part of our white Western racism, is not necessarily part of Christianity. So, I mean, if you're frustrated with the way you see Christianity being practiced, I'd encourage you to get in touch with Christianity in Africa. Because I think, I mean, I know that that my own Christian faith was much strengthened by, well, it has at several points in my history been strengthened by a recognition that the Christian faith is much broader than that which I've been exposed to. You know, I grew up in the Missouri Synod, and there came a time when I just thought, there's no way I can handle that. And then I really went through a crisis of wondering whether or not I was a Christian, until I got to first to the University of Chicago Divinity School, which Missouri Synod considers a bunch of heretics, and found out that the Christian tradition was much broader than I had ever been informed to believe, and then went from Chicago to Africa and found out that it was even broader out there in the world than people at Chicago had told me. And I expect I'll continue to have those lessons. So I would caution you not to give up your Christian faith on the basis of that practice of Christianity to which you've been exposed, but rather urge you to broaden your experience of the church. The reason I make a presentation like this one, let me back up. One difference, I've been pointing to parallels between Western society, First World, Third World crisis, and the crisis in Southern Africa. One difference, I think, and this, in a capsule, is why I do what I do and encourage people to take more of an interest in Southern Africa. One difference about Southern Africa is that it's far away from us. And I think the further away an issue is, the easier it is for us to make judgments about it. If I address a group of Christians at a church in an adult class in Seattle on a Sunday morning about racism in America, people are not very willing to make judgments about that, at least not to make judgments which are critical of our practice of racism. If I talk about the situation in Southern Africa, it's far enough away, people feel far enough removed from it, that they're willing to commit themselves. Like Kaunda says, you know, that's what we got to do. We got to be willing to take a stand. And then once you take a stand, you're in the position of having to defend it, and then a little creative tension emerges between you and the other person. If you just stand away and say, well, I'm not really too interested in it, or I don't really have an opinion about it, your own ideas are never challenged. Southern Africa is far enough away that we can be seduced into making a judgment. And as soon as we do that, if we're serious about exploring the issue, we will find out a little bit further down the road that there are parallels. But having already committed ourselves to the judgment that whites in South Africa are wrong and that they need to listen to blacks, and trying to communicate with black and white South Africans about that, the lesson which is going to come back to us is that there are parallels, and just as I have been able to see that white South Africans are wrong, maybe that will seduce me into an understanding that I need to make changes in my own situation as well. And so I lift up the South African issue amid so many other possibilities for you to give your attention as a very seductive one that I think has a lot of potential for turning us around in our own situation. And I sure appreciate the chance this week to say that.
See you later.